This Saturday is the 7th of April 2018, and it's exactly 50 years since Saturday, the 7th of April 1968. And the reason that date is significant is because it was on that day that the very first 12 men and women were ordained into what was then the Western Buddhist Order by Sangharakshita in London. So we're going to be celebrating, as an order, we're going to be celebrating on Saturday here the 50th anniversary of the order. So this evening is really a celebration of that, both looking back and looking forward. And what I'd like to do is try and give you a bit of a sense of what that's got to do with us all sitting here this evening. I have an interesting life. I do many different projects. I'm very fortunate. And two of the projects are relevant to this, so I couldn't help but bring them in. One by request. Ben did say to me, are we going to get a sneak preview of the 50 Years, 50 Voices project? And that is something I'm going to do tonight. So this project is something that I've been working on since last year, and it's for our whole Sangha worldwide. I've been interviewing, and other people have been interviewing, 50 different order members to find out how they practice the Dharma. And we're bringing all these recordings together to create a kind of hologram of the order. So I'm going to weave in some of those voices this evening. And another project I've been putting a lot of energy into is the complete works of Sangharakshita, our founder. And I'm going to mention them along the way as well, because I think actually, in thinking about our order and our movement, these two things are very important. The complete works are like the teachings, the theory, the foundations of the teachings of what we practice. And this other project that I've been describing, 50 Voices, is like the lived, messy reality of that. And they go very much kind of hand in hand, like one's a living analogue of the other, if you like. That's how I feel about them. So yeah, I want to explore what is the order and what's it got to do with us sitting here. A bit about what is the vision behind it. What is the sometimes messy lived reality of the order, and why does it matter kind of going forward? What's the implication for all of us? So I'll start with us all sitting here. We're sitting here in the Bristol Buddhist Centre. Classes happen. We come to them. And some of us, not everyone that comes, but some of us catch something as we come here. It's not actually a virus, but it's not unlike a virus. It can have a very big effect on us, what we catch, when we catch the Dharma. And it can change our lives forever, if that's what we want, if we practice and we make that happen. It can change us and lead us beyond suffering. That's what the Buddha taught. And what we catch is the living Dharma. There's the Dharma you can read in books, but it's very, very different when you actually catch it from other people who are practicing. And once we do catch that spark, that virus, whatever it is, we actually become part of this lineage of Dharma practice that actually goes all the way back to the Buddha. We're only able to practice now because that teaching, that flame's been handed on and handed on. And so we're actually part of a new unfoldment of the Buddhist tradition. 50 years isn't very long in the whole history of Buddhism. So we're a very young movement, a very young lineage. And actually we're right in the middle of being founded. It's not like it was done sometime in the past and now we're just in it and it's all sorted out and settled. Buddhist lineages take decades and decades, often over 100 years or more, to found. And it could be, as with some of the other traditions, that somebody who's going to be a really important teacher in our tradition hasn't even been born yet. This we see with some of the Tibetan traditions, the first founders back in the midst of time, and then someone else comes along. So we're very much part of carrying that living Dharma forwards. As I say, you could say it's a bit like catching a virus, or you could say it's like we catch fire when we catch the Dharma. It's like we're a lamp that gets lit. Like we say in the short puja, the lamp of Bodhi shining within our hearts that we've lit from the light of the Buddha. Or on the Adishtana website, you know, there's that lovely quote from Mala, that tradition is the handing on of the flame, not the worship of ashes. So we're talking about something very live, but what is this flame? Well, actually, if anyone could describe it, it would be dead and out by the end of the sentence. It's very ineffable. You can't pin it down. That's kind of part of the magic and the joy and the mystery and the utter frustration of it at times. But many of us can recognise it. At certain times we get a glimpse of it, but we can't pin it down. And to cut a very long story short, this is a way of describing why we need a Buddhist order. It's a living community of people who've got enough of a shared experience and understanding of what constitutes that ineffable mystery and magic. They can recognise it, we can recognise it in our own experience, in other people's experience. And we've got a pretty good idea from our years of practice and studying the Buddha's teachings of how to keep that flame alive, what conditions we need to keep that magic going in our lives. And for many of us, when we've had that experience, we also want to share it with others. And that's why we have the Buddhist Centre. That's what the Buddhist Centre is. It's people who've got a sense of that spark, that flame of the Dharma, who want to share it and pass it on. We can't practice alone. We can't keep that flame alight on our own. The worldly winds would blow it out very, very quickly. Anybody who's really tried to practice on their own, they're very exceptional individuals, very, very exceptional individuals manage it, but most of us, we need the support and encouragement and inspiration of each other, and also people who really know what is actually the Dharma. So, yeah, in a way, that's the heart of what we're doing here, and the rest is incidental. So I wanted to say a bit about the vision behind the order. As I say, it was founded exactly 50 years ago in London. And a week after that, there was a retreat. And Sangharakshita gave three talks, one on the Buddha, one on the Dharma, one on the Sangha. And they're all there on Free Buddhist Audio if you want to hear them. They're number 1, 2, and 3 of a numbered series that runs to hundreds and thousands now. They're right at the start. And I'm just going to play you 1 minute and 35 seconds where Sangharakshita is talking about the Dharma. And he's talking about the task before us. So he's founded the order, the new order members are there, and he's talking about this vision of the living Dharma.
Now in this country, we're in process of introducing Buddhism, the Dharma, the Buddhist spiritual tradition, Buddhist spiritual life. I think we may say that Buddhism in this country, as and when it develops, is very unlikely to follow any existing Buddhist path, because our needs, our approach, our background in this country are different from those of any Eastern country. What we have to do in this country is to draw upon the essence, the inner spirit of the Buddha's teaching, as preserved in all schools, take the best, not just in the eclectic sort of way, not just intellectually, but draw upon them deeply and spiritually, and unite and blend them all into one great stream of spiritual tradition adapted to the needs of people in this country. This is really the task which is before us. It isn't very easy to do. It's something which will demand a great deal of effort and spiritual experience on our part. It's a very vast subject, incidentally. I don't want to touch upon it really this morning. But let us bear it in mind that the Dharma really represents not this doctrine, not that teaching, but a great current of spiritual life in which we can participate, in which we can help others to share, and which sweeps us on, bears us on at any rate, eventually in the direction of enlightenment, in the direction of nirvana.
So that's Sangharakshita talking 50 years ago, the task before us. Now we're 50 years on into this task, and order members have been living and practicing and sharing the Dharma in the light of that vision. As I said, I've been working on this project, 50 Years, 50 Voices, which is capturing some of that experience, reflections, memories. And I've been talking to quite a few people. One of the people I've been talking to is Visantra, who's an order member who's had a lot to do with the centre here. He's been practicing a very long time. He was ordained in 1974. And he wanted to talk, when I interviewed him, about his experience of Sangharakshita, the light and the dark. And also he speaks of a great current of spiritual life or energy coming through Sangharakshita that founded the order. So I'll give you a little taste of Visantra.
The time it's like, you know, it was just quite obviously very different, yeah, very refined states. And they're very concerned a lot of the time, you know, to act out of metta rather than putting any pressure on people and all kinds of things. I think sometimes people now, not having had experience of Dante in the early days, they have a sense of him as a sort of old person who we're grateful to for founding Sri Ratna, who has his flaws and some sort of area around his sexuality that's caused a lot of difficulty. I don't think they always realise that along with those flaws there was an incredible strength and an incredible sort of energy which is what started Sri Ratna, if you like. Again, it's sort of something which came through him, so to speak. I mean, the everyday personality was in some ways quite sort of difficult to navigate, although he had incredible strengths, like just being so well read and being able to go out to so many different kinds of people. But in a way, there was something which came through Bhakti, which was really special, which really was full of Dharma qualities. And that's what started Sri Ratna. Yes, you can give good lectures and so on, but that doesn't really move people to put their whole lives into following you or to really inspire people in the way that he's inspired people. You have to be embodying the Dharma to a large extent, which doesn't mean all the time, and it doesn't mean that you're completely worked out. I do think that has been unskillful in some ways, but at the same time, there's also been these very strong Dharma qualities which have come through. Well, I think that has managed to also teach very well, but yeah, it is more of a spirit of something or an energy or qualities, I suppose, qualities which come through from a person or through a person, which aren't about what they say, they are about what they can contact and the depths of them. It's about somebody who is living from those depths or somebody who has those depths too.
So that's Visantra talking in Cambridge in February when I went to interview him. I wanted to leap now to Melbourne. I've been teaching at Adishtana on the 5-month residential course for young women, and I met a Turkish mitra called Itia, who actually lives in Melbourne. And I asked her to interview another very long-standing order member, Buddhadasa, who was the very first person to work full-time for the movement. He was the first person to go, right, I'm giving up this conventional life, I'm going to put all my energy behind this movement. And he's carried on doing that his whole life, serving Bhante. Actually, a few years ago, when Bhante was very unwell, the person he wanted by him was Buddhadasa. And at 2 weeks' notice, Buddhadasa came from Melbourne to Adishtana at the age of about 70 and stayed for a couple of years helping look after Bhante. He's back in Melbourne now. And this is a snip of a conversation of him, Itia, and him talking about spiritual community. And she's asking him about it. And he goes on to explain why the order doesn't really exist.
And where is the spiritual community?
Where? Well, in a sense, it's nowhere. It's transcendent. It doesn't have a place. It can't be defined. But its members know each other. That's why, it's forgotten sometimes that the order doesn't exist, you know, not legally. You can't find the order in legal terms anywhere. Mm-hmm. In a way, you can't say that where the order exists or where it has its being or its base. It can only have its base in the hearts of individual order members. Mm-hmm. And that suggests those order members concerned are in contact with each other. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. It's a little bit mysterious, isn't it? It's not just a collection of individuals and talk about the spiritual community.
Mm. It's very mysterious, and I think that we need to rejoice in the mystery.
Yeah.
And I hinted at that earlier when I'd had this intimation of the Arya Sangha,
yeah, yeah,
and the relationship between the Arya Sangha,
mm-hmm,
and what we are doing today.
Mm-hmm.
Bhante refers to what he describes as the suprapersonal force.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been particularly comfortable with that description because of the word force,
mm-hmm,
though I accept it. I tend to use in my own mind a guiding principle, because I've always felt in my own life I've had a guiding principle,
mm-hmm,
even from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed that, and I still follow it. But it's as intimately connected with my life as an order member, what I'm doing, but also what the order can become.
So in that extract, Buddhadasa mentioned the Arya Sangha. There's a lot one could say about that, but let's just say it's the Sangha beyond space and time, the Sangha of enlightened beings. So the final extract in this section I wanted to play you is from an interview that I recorded in 2012 with Vajratara, who now lives at the Tiruvannaloka Women's Retreat Centre. She used to be in Sheffield, in the Sheffield Buddhist Centre. This one hasn't had the magic done on it by Chandradasa, so it is a lot quieter. But I asked her, what does she see when she looks at the order? So this is some of the things that she sees when she looks at the order.
When I look at the Sangha, or particularly the order, what I just see is a very, very sincere group of men and women who are willing to examine themselves and their practice, and maybe it comes back to this creative tension of between keeping with the tradition and experimentation, and actually that people really want to strive to understand. Practice the Dharma in the conditions of the modern world. I think that's what I love about it. I just love the people, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually, just looking around, you know, order events and stuff, with incredible sort of affection. Yeah, all these unsung heroes and heroines plodding away in the Buddhist centre, mm-hmm, for years and years. You know, the kind of the unity and the diversity within that. You know, you've got people who are just so different, and then, but there's also something that holds them very much together.
Mm.
You know, which is the sincerity of practice of the Dharma.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. It's going to a convention and just looking around the room.
Yeah.
And people giving their offerings. I don't know if it's a legend, but anyway, apparently Arlaka said, well, you join the order for what it will be in 500 years' time, not what it is now. I see the way, that's what I also love, is the potential. I just don't think we understand half of what we've got,
mm-hmm,
that Bhante's given us.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of, that's also what I love, is what could be, what we could create.
So what Vajratara touched on there is that potential, that actually we're part of laying the foundations for what could be in hundreds of years' time. And she mentioned Arloka, who'd said that. He's the order member and the artist who painted the Buddha painting that's hiding behind this painting of Ratnasambhava. He's another very long-standing member of our order. So I wanted to say a bit about how big this vision of Bhante's is and was in founding the order, and where we can find it if we want to go and find more about it. And if there's one book which sums up the vision behind the Tiruvannaloka Buddhist Order and behind our whole movement, it's this. And in here is a book that Sangharakshita wrote remarkably and precociously at the age of 27, A Survey of Buddhism. He wrote it, it was published in 1957, and I increasingly think of it as our root text. Often a branch of the Buddhist tradition has something that is a kind of root text. And I think for us, this is it, actually. So this is actually a sneak preview of the newest edition. This is effectively the 11th edition of the survey, which is in the first volume of the complete works. It's a bit confusing because four volumes have already come out. They're not coming out in numerical order. This is actually numerically the first one because it is the most foundational. And so you get the whole of this book, the survey, and you also get the other classic, the Noble Eightfold Path book, which I expect many of you have read. And it's a fantastic combination because you've got this vast vision in the survey. And actually, with the Noble Eightfold Path book, you get like the companion practice manual. It's very, very practical about ideas and ways of practicing the Dharma. So I spent weeks and weeks and weeks last summer indexing the hundreds of pages of the Survey of Buddhism. I think we've got a 40 or 50 page index because I was determined that people would actually find what they needed and wanted in there without necessarily reading it from back to front or front to back. And it's extraordinary, the vision, what's in it. I mean, there's four chapters, but they're very big chapters. The first chapter forms a crucial part of our ordination training. There's a two-week retreat that we do as part of our ordination training called the Transcendental Principle. So it's like the principle Buddhadasa mentioned. It's what's really at the heart, that ineffable, whatever it is that's at the heart of how we understand and communicate the Dharma. It doesn't explain it, but it gives us ways of approaching it. First chapter. Second chapter, 27-year-old Sangharakshita gives a very thoroughgoing critique of the rest of the Buddhist tradition. It's nothing if not bold. And he'd spent by this time quite a bit of time travelling both in India and in Sri Lanka. And he's pretty unstinting in his criticism of the places where he felt that the flame of the Dharma had died. And he particularly found in some aspects of some ways that some parts of the Theravada tradition were practicing, there'd become this real monastic formalism. You know, there were people were just revered because of the robes, not because they were actually practicing. There was a real literalism in the way that the Buddha's teachings were being interpreted. They got more and more and more literalized. And so he really critiques that and goes on to explain a different vision, which comes from the Mahayana, the later phase of Buddhism, of the three bodies of the Buddha, which is one way of freeing oneself from these limitations and also of describing the deepening spiritual experience that we have as we practice the Dharma. And this three bodies of the Buddha teaching, the Trikaya, is actually the theme for our big Sangha retreat. So it's right there in the heart of what we're doing here and now. Similarly, in the next chapter, chapter three, again, Sangharakshita gives a big overview of the main schools of Buddhism and how they each approach. He describes, he's got a scheme for seeing how they all relate to approaching this central mystery. And I could spend a long time talking about that, but to cut it short, he's as if he describes a mandala, a bit like the mandala that we're exploring on Sangha nights at the moment. There are different qualities, different angles, different ways of approaching. So that principle of the mandala is right in here, and he's applying it to a huge chunk of the Buddhist tradition and explaining to us how we can draw on that if we understand it in the right context. And then the last chapter is very much about the altruistic dimension of Dharma practice, the Bodhisattva ideal. Some of his thinking moved on a bit in that from when he was 27, but the basic principles are still very much what we understand as the Bodhisattva ideal, the altruistic dimension of going for refuge. So, as I say, I wanted to just say all that because I do think we need to understand where our roots are. And this is like our root text. And it does illustrate this vast, broad, deep understanding. I had an image, I think I was talking to Ellie the other day, actually, and I had this image of it. It's like Sangharakshita has given us this great big mansion with all these floors and all these dimensions. And actually, when we start practicing, one or other of us can really enjoy just being in like one room on one level. You can dwell there for years and it's fine. But actually, as we grow, we need these other dimensions. We sometimes need a different way of approaching it, or we need to go deeper, or we need to go higher. We need the vision, and we need the understanding of the whole mansion that he sort of dreamed up for us in this vision. And we need to preserve that, not just the bits that we're enjoying at the moment, that are fashionable at the moment. And that's why I just feel so passionately about these complete works. You know, they're going to be 27 volumes. In a way, you've got the pith in here, and then you've got the rest of his life's work unfolding that so that you can really explore in great detail whichever bit is really kind of firing you, but understanding that it's part of a bigger whole, that there is this transcendental principle, but there's just myriad ways of approaching it. So, yeah, that's why I see the complete works, you know, going hand in hand with a lived Dharma practice. They're not just some dusty thing that we're going to put on a shelf and it's going to be very worthy. So, yeah. And then there's the messy reality of what happens when we start trying to practice the Dharma. I'm probably going to need to speed up a bit. So I think what I'm going to do is jump to my next extract, which is someone who was a very dear friend of many of us, who died 7 years ago, and that's Manjushvara. And rather magically, I found that a talk he'd given in 2007 had never been published. So I had a CD of it at home, but it's never actually made it out there. And it was almost like finding a termer from him with... It's almost like he was answering the questions I'd have asked him if he was still alive. Anyway, this is him talking about the problem of perfection. It's part of an extract. He's read a poem that he wrote, and it's got this lovely line in it about just the right amount of perfection.
Little kids dancing down the street have just the right amount of perfection to do the dance and not worry what they look like. As we get older, we lose that right amount of perfection, okay? So this is the bit you touched on, possibly, the more controversial. If you don't want to hear this, you can leave that. If you think that the FWBO is perfect, I suggest you leave the room. Because you know what? It ain't. And you know why? Because I'm not perfect. He's not perfect. She's not perfect. And very few of us are perfect. Some of you might be. I hope so. But I'm certainly not. And most of the people I know in a Western Buddhist order, including its founder, are not perfect. And that can be quite a struggle. And I think for some it remains a struggle to come to terms with that. But actually, to me, that's a great gift. This shows how people can work together happily, beautifully, with imperfection. What a great thing. I mean, who needs perfection? Perfection's useless in the human life because we don't touch perfection with it. So, in a sense, the imperfection of the Western Buddhist order is a great gift. How does this manifest, this imperfection? Well, funny enough, it's the desire for perfection. There's been a lot of this in the FWBO. I think we're getting better at it. But we get the teachings and suddenly, whoosh, like that, you know, we're on a runner. We leave all this mucky stuff behind. We become holier than now, purer than pure. We're Buddhas. And it's all nonsense, you know. I don't think the Buddha was doing that. The Buddha lived in squalor. If you've ever walked around the world, India, you're going to hit squalor pretty quickly. He lived and breathed it. So don't do the, you know, rising above it all trick, because in the end you come back down, I assure you.
So he said a lot of other great things in that talk, but you'll have to wait to hear about them. So, moving on to the next section of what I wanted to say. So, why does the order matter? I think fundamentally it matters because there is suffering in the world. And as far as we can tell, it looks like that suffering's getting worse and it's not getting better. And as any of us who've tried to change the world know, you can't change the world without changing yourself, without transforming your own heart and mind and those of other people. So another interview that was recorded for the project was in February, and it was actually in Bodh Gaya in India on our order convention, so the very place where the Buddha gained enlightenment. And in this interview, this conversation, you've got Parami, who's our international order convener, who's been ordained nearly 40 years from Scotland, and she's in conversation with a young Indian order member called Shraddha Vajri, very dynamic woman, black belt in karate. She's absolutely extraordinary, lives in this very remote part of India, miles away from anyone else in the order, teaching the Dharma. Actually a very dangerous situation. She came on the Dharma Life course at Adishtana a couple of years ago, and she couldn't believe when she was here that she had 5 months of feeling safe. It's impossible to imagine what her life is like. And for, obviously, the hundreds and thousands of our Dharma brothers and sisters in India who are practicing the Dharma, who've converted from Hinduism and who've left behind the hell of caste. In this section, Parami and Shraddhavajri are talking about really wanting to change the world. And there's this lovely bit when Shraddhavajri talks about, you have to listen quite carefully because she talks quite quickly, but she talks about being an anger girl in her youth. And she and Parami agree that they were both anger girls who want to change the world. So we'll just hear from them.
You were saying before that our conditioning is very different.
Yeah.
Being a woman in India and a woman in a more modern, let's say, situation. But I think the inspiration is the same.
Yeah.
Because for me, I became involved. First, I was involved in politics. And I really wanted to change the world. And then I saw that you can only change the world really through changing mind.
Mind, yes.
So it was the same idea, the same vision.
Yeah, an idea.
And then I heard Sangharakshita talk about, very first talk I ever heard, he was saying you cannot just change your mind, you need to change the world.
Yeah.
But you cannot change the world if you don't change your mind.
Mind, yes.
So that very same inspiration, very similar.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when they give this opportunity, now in India, I also be. I'm not going to change the world, but first I change to myself.
Yeah.
I can see, I am in my childhood, I'm very anger girl.
Me too.
I think both are the personality.
Yeah.
It's very anger. And it's still, I feel some firing inside my mind.
Yeah.
Very much firing. Yeah. Sometimes, but I just always remembering those words, just like Bhante said, means about the mind. And Baba Sahib said, means what mind create, mind can undo. And these things is very much alive inside me. And I always feel, whenever I feel this firing inside me, I feel what mind can create, mind can undo, Shraddha, already work yourself. Yeah. And then you work for society.
So there were clanging pots and things. Obviously, they were in the place where the cooking was happening. When Shraddhavajri was here, she would often say, you practice yourself, you pay back to society. You pay back to society. I think this was a saying of Dr. Ambedkar. She referred to him, Baba Saheb, who was the great leader of the Indian Untouchables who converted to Buddhism in 1956 with thousands and thousands of his followers. So that's just a little taste of some of the voices in the 50 Voices project. It's actually going to go live this week. There'll be some information starting to appear, but it's going to gradually appear through the year. So I need to wrap up. We've looked at what is the order, what's the vision behind the order, what the messiness, the right amount of perfection, the wrong amount of perfection, and why does it matter to have an order and a sangha. And I wanted to just finish with four things that you can do if you choose to. So there's that sense of we've got this great tradition behind us, we've got the 50 years of the order. How it goes forward depends on us and people like us all around the world. Most importantly is just keep coming, keep connecting with the Sangha, keep meditating, tending that flame in your heart and supporting each other to do that. And noticing the effects on your life when you stop doing that. We all do. We all stop at different times. You notice, oh, actually something here needs a bit more tending, a bit more care. I'd also say read, listen, study the Dharma, and especially as elucidated by Sangharakshita. I love that word, elucidate. It means bring light to, explained, explored. The elucidation of the Dharma by Bhante. And obviously a fantastic way to do that is to subscribe to the Complete Works. It does need people to subscribe to it for it to carry on, to have the money to keep getting published. So it's not just a question of buying the book for yourself. It's actually buying, supporting, putting resources into the foundations. I mean, they are a bit like foundation bricks, aren't they? You know, of the teachings that will be useful to people in the future beyond us. If we can make sure we get all these into print. But also, it's important, and I just wanted to mention, to actively support the work of our movement, like the work Will does and Chandra Dasa at Free Buddhist Audio and the BuddhistCentre.com. We can take them for granted, but it needs funding. It needs support. Clear Vision videos, the development of teacher training, ordination training, people going and pioneering the Dharma around the world, Indian Buddhist youth, translation of the Dharma, all that is supported by this new fund that was set up a couple of years ago that is called the Future Dharma Fund. You've probably seen stuff about it. Their strapline is, the world needs what you've been given, pass it on. So it's an invitation to consider, you know, money, energy, it's actually different forms of the same thing, and actually if you want to flow some of your energy in the direction of the Dharma moving forward, the Future Dharma Fund is a fantastic way to do that. But most of all, keep turning towards whatever arises in your path. Keep connecting. Nobody's perfect. The order isn't perfect, the Sangha isn't perfect, but there's something precious among us, even if it's difficult at times. We need to keep turning towards. That's at the heart of positive emotion, and that's our theme for Sangha Night this term. So we've got some time for groups, because I thought it would be great to actually have a chance to discuss and explore this together. Couple of things you can think about in your groups. One is, last week Pranyamati did set a home practice, which was, if a difficult emotion turns up during the week, try turning towards it and being with it. Some of you may have done that, you might like the opportunity to talk about that, but don't worry if you haven't. You could also explore, how do you respond to the idea of tending this flame of the Dharma in yourself? And how do you see, if you do that, it could also benefit other people as well as yourself? So there's a couple of questions for meeting in groups. We're going to have... one more thing. I've got a homework for you for the coming week. Is that if you want to, you could just undertake each day to turn your mind to this image of tending the flame of the Dharma. Might be something you just bring to mind before meditation. You might want to reflect on it. You might want to write about it. You might want to make something to remind you to put, if you have a shrine or a special place, make something to just remind you and bring that to mind during the week, and then you can report back on that next week.